Now, you've hopefully all got the course outline, which is available on a PDF file on the BSWA website. If you don't have that, then please get it. If you need it printed out, then please talk to the people at the desk, and the wonderful volunteers here will help you to get what you need. That course outline has readings for each month's workshop. Please do the readings. Read them. Read them carefully. Read them more than once if you can. The reading is an essential part of this course. In fact, to be honest, most of the course is really just trying to get you to do the readings and giving you some motivation to do that. Because I know that so many people I've spoken to, they said, you know, they really want to learn a bit more about the suttas and stuff, but it's, you know, it's hard to know where to get started and so on and so forth. So this is trying to give you that support to get into that that habit. And you really will miss out on a lot if you haven't done the readings for each month. In addition to that, we've also got in the course outline, it gives you meditations to do for each month. Yeah, so this also is a way of integrating the teachings, bringing them back home, bringing them into experience. So you just try to practice each of these meditations at least a few times a week in between the courses, and we can also practice them in between the workshops, and we can also practice them today as we do our meditations. Remember that as we're doing this course, we can only present one aspect of things here, okay? We're going to be talking about Buddhist texts. We're going to be talking about ideas and so on. So it's going to be about the theory of it. And it's important to remember that early Buddhism, like any form of Buddhism, is not just a theory. And I'm sure that you should all be familiar with this, but I just want to emphasize it because sometimes when we present from this basis, it sounds like we're trying to say that if you want to understand early Buddhism, you have to become an expert in all these languages and Buddhist philosophy and so on and so forth. No, that's not the point. The point is that if we're informed, yeah, part of our journey, part of our exploration of Dhamma is to correct our views, to improve our understanding and to deepen our appreciation of the theory of Buddhism. That's part of what we're doing, and that's the part that we're going to be mainly presenting over this course. But we're going to be trying to keep on integrating and pointing to how this is also relevant for how we experience the Dhamma, how we practice, how we realize these teachings. So please don't mistake this emphasis that we're going to be having in this course. Another thing we need to be careful of is that we don't fall into a early Buddhist fundamentalism. Okay, so this is something which is quite easy to do. So we can say, oh yes, you know, this is right because this is something that's in early Buddhism, and that's wrong because that's something in later Buddhism. Okay, early doesn't mean right. Late doesn't mean wrong, okay? What this is, and this is not also a sectarian argument. It's not about saying that some schools of Buddhism are right because they're early and other schools of Buddhism are wrong because they're late. That's not the point. The point is simply to try to understand what it is that the Buddha taught and try to put that in a context, a time and place, so that we can appreciate what he's saying better. Once we understand that, we can then put into context all of the developments in the schools. We can understand why certain ideas were emphasized, why some things were changed, why some things were added, why some things were left out. And we can look at the history. We can understand how each of the Buddhist traditions has adapted the Dhamma to their own time and place. And what's even more important, we can understand how we are doing that here and now. Because one thing is for sure, that the Buddhism that you and I are practicing here and now is not early Buddhism. It's in fact the very latest Buddhism that there is, right? It's the Buddhism that's happening right now. So it's not about trying to recreate some imagined pristine past, okay? That's what fundamentalism is. It's about trying to learn from what the Buddha said so that we can integrate that and apply that in the most effective way that we can in the present. So it's very important to remember this. Up on the board here, on the screen, we have what's most probably the most famous summary or epitome of the Dhamma, and that's the verse which was given by Venerable Asaji to Venerable Sariputta when he asked for the to understand the gist. And so this happened when very early on in the dispensation of the Buddha, when Sariputta was still the student of another teacher. He hadn't become a Buddhist yet. And he saw Asaji wandering for alms, and he was very impressed by his demeanor. So he came and asked him, "Please, what's the teacher that you're following? What Dhamma is he teaching?" And when he was pushed for to make a summary, this is the summary that he came up with of those things that arise from a cause that Tathagata, that means the Buddha, has told the cause, and also what their cessation is. This is the doctrine of the great recluse. That means the Buddha, the Mahasramana. And here we see this verse in the English translation. On the left here we have it in Pali. Okay, so this would be the most familiar to from the Theravadan tradition. On the right we have the Sanskrit text of the same verse. Here we have the Sanskrit written in Tibetan. Here is, I think, a Tibetan translation. I don't read Tibetan, but that's what I guess it is. This is the Sanskrit in Devanagari script. And this is the Pali in Sinhalese script. I should have other ones on there. I should have Chinese and Korean and Thai and Burmese and Japanese and Mongolian. But you'll forgive me for not having found all of those yet. I'll work on it, though. Okay. So there's a number of remarkable things about this verse, okay? First thing is how mundane it is. Right? This is a religious. This is a religion, right? Normally, if you say what's the essence of your religion, right? It's, well, our essence of our religion is that the Lord God has created the universe and He controls all things and He loves you, right? And that's like a kind of really powerful and inspiring thing. But then here we say, what does Buddha teach? Oh, yeah, stuff rises and then passes away, right? It's like big deal, right? So it's very remarkable that this is right at the center of the Buddha's teachings. And this isn't not just an obscure verse. This verse is inscribed and repeated hundreds of times all throughout Buddhist history on stupas and monasteries and monuments all over the Buddhist world. This verse is the one which is expressed most often as the essence of what the Dhamma is. Those things that arise from a cause, that a target has told the cause and what their cessation is. That's the teaching of the Buddha. So always kind of remember this, that what the Buddha's pointing back to is an understanding of experience, an understanding of reality. Yeah? It's a very grounded teaching. It's a very realistic teaching. Yeah? So when we're looking into the teachings more, we begin to understand what is the context of this. Okay, this is not just a generic scientific assertion that everything has a cause. This is an injunction for how you live your life. Essentially, of course, what it means is that if you follow your craving and greed, hatred and delusion, then you give rise to suffering for yourself and others. And if you let go of greed, hatred and delusion, you let go of suffering for yourself and others. And this is those causes and the cessation of those causes, which is implied by this verse. And this is like the thread which goes through the whole teaching. And what you can see, what's interesting about this is not only that this is found in the early Buddhist texts, it's found all through the Indian Buddhism. And you can see how, and every school, every language is translated. And you can see, if you look here, now I know not all of you will be experts in Middle Indo-Aryan languages, okay? But even those of you who may be less than expert can see how similar these words are. Okay, this is the Pali and the Sanskrit. Ye dhamma hetu pabhava. Sanskrit, ye dharma hetu pabhava. Okay, it's just a slight difference in the dialect. Te sang hetung tathagato aha. In the Sanskrit, hetang te sang tathagata. It's missing the last word, aha. So you might think there's a difference. That just means said. Okay, you might think that's different. Actually, the word here, yavadat, means the same thing. It's just been slightly different form. It's the same word. Te sancha nirodha. Te sancha nirodha is exactly the same. Evan vadi mahasramana. So when we say that these teachings are the core teachings of Buddhism. When we say that they are held within all the Buddhist schools and that they have been for the whole history of Buddhism, we don't mean that in just a vague and general way. We're not saying that these there's a kind of a spirit of Buddhism or a philosophy which can be discerned. What we're talking about is actual explicit teachings which are word for word identical. And this is not just an isolated case. There are literally thousands of early Buddhist texts which are virtually word for word identical across all the Buddhist traditions, as far as we've been, our research is being able to uncover. And so when we come to look at what is early Buddhism, we have a very kind of strong basis to come back and say there's something which is very foundational to everything that which has happened in Buddhism. Everything which has gone on, all the traditions, they all look back to these teachings which we find right there from the beginning. Okay, so that's I've been talking for nearly 20 minutes now, so let's have 10 minutes break and have a short meditation. Let our mind settle and let everything settle down. So for most of the this morning's session, I'm going to be focusing on something about the history and the evolution of the idea of early Buddhism. But first, I want to look at, just to reflect a little bit, why we're here. What's the outcome of this course? What's the purpose of it? The most basic one, of course, is to understand Buddhism better. We also want to try to appreciate the historical context, okay, the time and the place that the Buddha taught. When we read the Buddhist scriptures, it's very apparent that each text begins on at such an occasion, the Buddha was staying in such and such a place, and then he spoke to such and such people. Yeah? Every Buddhist text, it makes a point of saying that. There's a time, there's a place, there's certain people. Yeah? Every Buddhist text, at least in theory, every early one, has those things. It's a contextual teaching. It's a record of a series of an oral transmission of doctrine. So, if we want to understand that better, then we have to learn something about what that time was like, what that place was like, what those people were like. From there, we can start to meaningfully bring that into our lives and apply it in our context. But one thing which I think we should be wary of, and something which I notice is always the tendency when we're studying early Buddhism, that these are people, I think, are usually in too much of a hurry to try to apply it to their own lives. That's why in this course we've left that to the end of the course. That's what the last workshop is going to be about. Put those questions aside for now. You're never going to understand what it is that this meant in that time and that place if every time you hear something, you're immediately saying, what does that mean for me? How do I apply this on Tuesday when I have my job interview? Right? The guys the Buddha was talking to didn't do job interviews. They didn't do tax returns. I mean, sometimes they might have done. They did live very, very different lives. So we appreciate the differentness of that and understand that context for what it is. Take time to do that. That's quite interesting in and of itself. It's an exercise in compassion, placing yourself in someone else's shoes, seeing how they would see it from their point of view. Huh? When we've done that, when we've got a feel for how that was in that time and that place, then we can meaningfully ask the question, how do we then apply that in our life? But if we're in too much of a hurry, we don't end up getting any perspective on the difference between our situation and the situation in those days. And you see, this happens all the time in Buddhism, all the time. I'll just give you one simple example. In Buddhism, we often talk about the word consciousness. We're translating a Pali word. The Pali word is vijnana. Now, in modern psychology, in modern Western terms, consciousness is purely a question of what you're aware of, the thoughts, moods, emotions, and so on you have in the present time. But in the ancient Indian context, the word vijnana was also commonly used for the principle that underlies rebirth. Okay, and that you find all through the Indian tradition and also all through the Buddhist tradition. In fact, in Thai, the word vijnan means ghost, right? We translate it as consciousness, but colloquially it means ghost. Yeah? So once we've made that translation, if we then bring those teachings into a Western context, we're going to systematically misinterpret all of those teachings where vijnana is talked about in the context of rebirth. Okay? And this is the kind of elementary mistake which we find people making again and again and again when they're reading the Buddhist scriptures without taking proper account of the historical context. So another purpose of these courses is to be able to approach the Buddha's words and see what it is that he taught, how he taught, why he taught in that particular way. To be able to meaningfully and with reason to discern what it is that he did teach and what it is that he didn't teach. Not just coming from our own presuppositions and preferences. Sometimes we might find that the things that he actually taught were things that we don't like. Right? The fact that we don't like something doesn't mean that the Buddha didn't say it. Maybe he said things that we don't like. Maybe he said things that were wrong. That's heretical, isn't it? No bolts of lightning, no pits or anything. We have to approach this in an open mind, yeah? There are clearly things that are said in the suttas and so on which are factually incorrect. Yeah, there talks about, you know, Mount Meru is this kind of mythical mountain and all of these kinds of things. And so there are some things that it's talked about in the suttas which and the early Buddhist texts which we know are factually incorrect. So maybe did the Buddha say those things? Did he not? Well, we have what we want to learn is some methods and some approaches to be able to meaningfully discern from what is likely to be authentic and what is likely to be not authentic. That we're going to talk about that in more detail in the next month's workshop. Find peace and true freedom. Okay, that's the goal of it, right? We want to be at peace. We want to be free. Studying. I find it astonishing, really, how little emphasis we find in Buddhist tradition to actually listening to what the Buddha said. We always listen to what this Ajahn says, or what that teacher says, or what that Sayadaw says, or that, and we don't listen to what the Buddha said. I can't understand it. But anyway, this is the purpose of it, to find peace and true freedom. I left one thing out of there, my mistake. Actually, the highest purpose of practicing Dhamma is not freedom and liberation or peace or anything like that. The highest purpose of doing this course and studying the Dhamma is to be able to win arguments on blogs. So if you want to win the internet, then you've come to the right place, okay? So after the course, you can say, I know this is right because I did the early Buddhism course, and that's it. Okay, so we're going to put the search for early Buddhism into a historical context. That means the modern context. When we talk about early Buddhism, implicit in the very word is the distinction is the idea that there's a difference between what's taught in the Buddhist traditions and something that was taught by the Buddha, right? And that itself is quite a radical idea. Because, of course, every tradition believes wholeheartedly that what it is teaching is, in fact, exactly the same as what the Buddha taught. Okay? Every tradition says that. And every tradition is wrong. Okay? Because both right and wrong. Because every tradition does, in fact, inherit many of the ideas and texts and practices of early Buddhism. But also every tradition has added many things to that. Okay? So the search for early Buddhism is actually something which you can discern throughout the history of Buddhism itself. And I won't go into this, but there are repeated discussions and opinions and so on about what it is that the Buddha did and didn't teach. And we can find that at every stage in Buddhist history. But what I'm going to trace for you this morning is about the modern history of that. How Buddhism was discovered in the West, and how that discovery in the West has also informed the nature of the Buddhist traditions that we experience today. Okay? Because when we approach Buddhism in modern times, we tend to have a very naive idea about what Buddhism is and what happens in Buddhist countries, and we have no idea of the complex interrelated history of how the Buddhist traditions as we find them have emerged. Now, convenient place to start is 1786, William Jones, and this is a very famous passage here. He said that William Jones was an English intellectual living in India, and he gave a presentation to one of the learned societies of the time, and he had this quote: "The Sanskrit language, whatever be its antiquity, is of a wonderful structure, more perfect than the Greek, more copious than the Latin, and more exquisitely refined than either, yet bearing to both of them a stronger affinity, both in the roots of verbs and the forms of grammar, than could possibly have been produced by accident. So strong, indeed, that no philologer could have examined them all three without believing them to have sprung from some common source, which, perhaps, no longer exists, There is similar reason, though not quite so forcible, for supposing that both the Gothic and the Celtic, though blended with a very different idiom, had the same origin with the Sanskrit, and the Old Persian might be added to the same family. First thing I'd just like to notice is what an awesome sentence that is. You just don't get sentences like that these days, do you, right? A number of remarkable things about this. I mean, first thing is you have a Western colonialist who's actually saying that there are actually things that are worthwhile in these pagan, primitive, barbaric Asian cultures, right? I mean, the history of colonialism is not a pretty one, and the Western has spent, you know, a lot of time putting everybody down and so on, and denigrating their local cultures and so on. And here we have an emergence of an appreciation. Well, actually, there's something going on here. Oh, better than Greek and Latin? For a European intellectual, that's a pretty remarkable kind of statement. And his suggestion that not only are these things similar to Greek and Latin, but they may well share a common root. This is something which had actually been suggested a number of times prior to this. And in fact, it must impress itself on the mind of anybody who studies these languages, that Sanskrit, Latin, Greek and so on clearly have a common origin. And this origin we now call the Indo-European language family. And most of the languages from Sri Lanka in the extreme southeast all the way to Norway and Iceland in the northwest, most of those languages are from the Indo-European language family, up as far as Russia, Persia, and so on. So here he's suggesting that there's some kind of cultural or philosophical or historical affinity between the Indian intellectuals, the Brahmanic caste who had passed down these Sanskrit texts, had some kind of affinity with the European intellectuals. So this is the beginnings of the academic study of Indian literature and Indian texts. In the early years, that study was mostly focused on the Sanskrit and the Hindu texts. Most of the learning was from the Hindu pundits, the Hindu intellectuals, which of course is very natural. And the idea of the Buddha as a part of Indian history wasn't really there. The Hindu histories sort of don't really talk about Buddhism. And it's not an easy thing to be able to tell, for example, that the religion practiced in Sri Lanka and the religion practiced in Tibet and the religion practiced in Japan are all actually the same religion, right? It's not obvious at all, okay? So it took quite a long time to gradually become aware that there is this thing called Buddhism, right? That all of these diverse forms of Buddhism come from a common origin, and that common origin was India. I mean, originally they postulated it might have been Ethiopia. That was one of the suggestions, right? So these things took time and a lot of work to be able to kind of figure out exactly what was going on there. And implicit in that very idea is emerging the idea of early Buddhism. Okay, so once we've appreciated that there are all these various different schools everywhere across Asia and that they all come back to India, but there's no longer a form of Buddhism in India, then the question arises, well, what was that source? What was that thing? That must have been something quite remarkable, okay? To have so much energy to spread across so many countries, to last for such a long period of time, this is no kind of ordinary teaching. There's lots of, you know, religious teachers and philosophers come up here and there and teach things, but this must have been something quite extraordinary. What was that Buddhism that happened in India? Was the Buddha a historical figure? Can we find these things out? So these are the questions which many of the European intellectuals started asking in those days. that inquiry was put on a solid intellectual and historical foundation by a generation of Indologists around the late 19th and early 20th century, the foremost figure of which was Thomas Rhys Davids. Now, it's in that period that the shape of the Buddhism that we experience today was really formed. And we're going to look at a number of the personalities from that era and look at different aspects. But in each of those aspects, we'll see that there's a common thread, which is finding a new inspiration from the idea of early Buddhism. And that inspiration manifested in all kinds of different ways. This is something which is very important. The idea of early Buddhism is not something I'm just inventing or I'm inventing now. It's something which has been around for well over a century. And it's not just a dry and arid intellectual historical inquiry. It's something which has resulted in an incredible revitalization and re-energization of Buddhism in every Buddhist country that it's touched, pretty much. And that is ongoing. So we're participating in that process. So by doing this course, I'm not trying to sort of propose a thing called early Buddhism. What I'm trying to do is to point to it, focus on it, and to raise it in our consciousness so it can be more clear exactly what's happening. Thomas Rhys Davids, 1843 to 1922. He was an English administrator. He lived in Sri Lanka. He was a lawyer, and one of his jobs was settling various legal disputes and so on. And then people would come to him and they would refer to the Vinaya as a source of legal precedent and legal arguments and so on. And so he heard this, there's this thing called the Vinaya. What's the Vinaya? It's an ancient text of the Buddhists and it's in Pali language. So he had to learn Pali so he could understand the Vinaya so he could make legal judgments. Okay, so he learned the Pali from, well, where can you learn Pali from? Go to the local temple, find some monks who are skilled in Pali. Okay, so they would teach him. The Indian, one of the things that we're very lucky with is that Indian languages are extremely well analysed and described, and they have been for over 2,000 years. Okay, from the time of Panini, who lived only about a century after the Buddha, he did an absolutely astonishingly precise and perfect grammar of Sanskrit. And since that time, really, there's been no improvement in our understanding of the grammar of any language, really. He did a perfect analysis of it. These days, we maybe explain it in a more simple way. But the basic grammar structure that he used still remains. So Thomas Rhys Davids was able to learn Pali using the various Pali grammars and reading materials at the time, and became very inspired and very interested by that literature. He later returned to England, where he founded the Pali Text Society in Oxford, and with the purpose of editing the Pali manuscripts. So at this time, all of the Pali text was in manuscript form. Actually, we should have some manuscripts here. Do we have any? Are there any manuscripts in the library? Don't think so. We don't have any manuscripts. See, that's how fast these traditions die, right? 100 years ago, all the Buddhist texts were in manuscript form. Now, almost none of them. They're just a historical curiosity. So they collected manuscripts from Sri Lanka, from Burma, and from Thailand, all in their own individual scripts, okay, with the goal of editing them and publishing them in books. Okay. Now, the books that he published, we see on the table over there, and we'll come back to a little bit later to look in more detail what they contain. But this is, you know, just to make that connection. That face you see on the board there, he was the one who's responsible for putting together those books. He didn't edit them personally himself, but he edited some of them. And he was the organizational genius and driving force behind getting those texts available. From those texts, the translations, all the modern translations of the Buddhist scriptures and so on, mostly are based on these texts. And it all comes from Thomas Rhys Davids. He also compiled a Pali dictionary, and he published many popular books on Buddhism. He travelled widely and lectured widely, was a very popular lecturer on Buddhism. So he really introduced an accurate historical understanding of Buddhism into the Western culture for the first time. He himself was not a Buddhist as such, but he said that having studied all of the philosophies of the world, that he has never found a way of life that's as complete and as meaningful as the Noble Eightfold Path, and he's content to live his life according to that Noble Eightfold Path. So this again is one of the key motifs of modern Buddhism, okay? That Buddhism has experienced in the West, we want to go back and find the real teaching, and we're quite happy to practice the Eightfold Path, but we might not want to call ourselves, I'm not really a Buddhist, I'm just somebody who practices the Eightfold Path, okay? And this is something that's still very common today in like secular Buddhism and things like that. And people aren't very, they don't really want to call themselves, Buddhist or something. I listen to Dalai Lama's books, and I meditate every day. And I come along to the Buddhist Society and listen to Ajahn Brahm's talks. And I keep precepts and stuff. I don't know if I consider myself a Buddhist, right? So. You see these tendencies starting up with Rhys Davids. Of course, he wasn't the only one. There was a generation of scholars. So I'm just picking out a few characters and personalities. Ledi Sayadaw. And so to remember that these traditions were not happening in isolation. Rhys Davids lived in Sri Lanka. Right? The Pali Text Society was founded on funding from Sri Lanka. Right? When they didn't have any funding in England, he wrote to Sri Lanka, to all the monks, and said, please help out. We want to do this. And they sent him money and funds to get started. You'll see in the introduction to some of the editions also, acknowledgement of funds donated from the King of Thailand and so on. So these people were working together. And there was mutual feedback from the different cultures. Ledi Sayadaw was, you notice, from the same period as Thomas Rhys Davids, and he was the most important figure in the reform of modern Burmese Buddhism. A very prolific writer. He wrote both in Pali and Burmese. From our point of view, it's kind of remarkable that he wrote long books in Pali. Okay. From his point of view, it was remarkable that he wrote books in Burmese. Okay. Again, this is a matter of the historical context. To write in the local colloquial language is again a modern innovation. So it's writing so that it can be disseminated and read, understood by the ordinary people. He was an advocate, even though he was a scholar monk, a great scholar, but he also advocated breath meditation, anapanasati, and vipassana. And it's really from his influence that the modern Burmese vipassana movements, the Mahasi technique, Goenka technique, and so on, that this arose. And vipassana is a quintessentially modernist movement. It's a reform of Buddhist meditation. It's not an ancient form of meditation by any means. Vipassana was invented in the 20th century as a way of stripping the superstitious, magical, and mystical elements from Buddhist meditation, okay, and presenting meditation as a purely rational and psychological process. And he was also introduced lay meditation and the idea of the lay meditation retreat. Ledi Sayadaw was in active correspondence with Carolyn Rhys Davids, Thomas Rhys Davids' wife. And she became president of the Pali Text Society after he died. And he, in his letters to her, he would write in Pali, he addressed her as Landana Pali Devi, yeah, the Pali angel of London. Okay, and they had these long discussions about sort of questions of Buddhist philosophy and psychology and so on. And she translated one of the Buddhist Abhidhamma books. She translated under the title of Buddhist Psychological Ethics. Okay, so she's introducing this idea she and Thomas Rhys Davids were making the connection between the new and emerging science of psychology, right? So it's the time also of Freud, William James, Carl Jung, and so on. And they were noticing that there are all these connections between this psychology teachings that are coming through and these Buddhist things that we're reading from Asia as well, because they're also talking about the mind. They're talking about conditionality. They're talking about how when you do something in the past, it will have these effects on you in the present. It's talking about how you have these unconscious tendencies that you're not aware of that will drive your behavior in certain ways. And so they notice all of these similarities between the psychology and the Buddhist teachings. And of course, this is the origins of course what has become completely mainstream in psychology today, is the idea of using mindfulness, meditation techniques, and Buddhist philosophy and so on in psychology is completely mainstream. And so that can be traced back to Ledi Sayadaw's generation. Okay, so it's time for another meditation. We'll sit quietly for another 10 minutes. Okay, so moving on to the next country, traditional Buddhism, Thailand. And, of course, the modern Buddhist reform there mostly started by the great figure of King Mongkut, spent many years as a monk before he became the king. And in his time as a monk, Mongkut was a voracious intellectual. He would kind of hunt down any kind of philosophers and scholars and so on who were in Bangkok at the time. He'd hunt them down and pump them for information and ideas about Western philosophy and science and so on. And he would often shock the Westerners by how skeptical he was. It seems that Mongkut didn't actually really believe in rebirth, and this was felt to be quite, well, a bit disturbing for some people. But he, when he became a monk, his story is almost like an encapsulation of the kind of some of the trends at the time. He spent his first reigns in a meditation monastery. And when he asked the teachers there, why do we do this? Why do we meditate in this way? What do we do? They said, we don't know. That's just what our teachers told us, so that's just what we say. And they had no ability to understand what they were doing and to explain it. And so Mongkut was very unsatisfied with this. He called it Achinna Kapikavada, the doctrine of just following along with the tradition. Okay? Achinna Kapikavada, and this actually is very interesting because this is a doctrine which is formally condemned by all Buddhist traditions in the Second Council, 100 years after the Buddha. So all Buddhist traditions accept that something is not just right because the tradition says so. And yet, even though that's what that idea was supposed to be condemned, it's in fact what we find throughout all the Buddhist traditions. So he wasn't happy with that, so he went back, learnt Pali, and embarked on quite a serious search for what could be considered as real Buddhism and the earliest Buddhist texts, earliest Buddhist teachings. He strongly emphasized the Vinaya as opposed to just following Thai cultural customs. Okay, and so often they might not be the same thing. And this is something that comes up many, many different times in cultures and so on. I'll just give you one example. In Chiang Mai, there's a monastery called Wat U Mong, and a monk called Lumpur Panyanando was staying there. Some of you might even remember him. He used to visit here. Did the ordination? I think, did he do your first ordination? Your novice ordination? Yeah, he did his ordination. When he was at Wat U Mong in Chiang Mai, they had this custom where once a year there would be a special ceremony for Upagupta. Now Upagupta was a monk from the ancient times who was regarded as a saint in that region, and they always have very funny ceremonies associated with Upagupta. Now Upagupta is only found in northern Theravada Buddhism, northern Burma and Thailand, and not found at all in Sri Lanka. But the custom there was that the monks had to go for alms round at 2 o'clock in the morning. Right? It's crazy. Once a year, all the monks of a monastery would get out and they'd wander through the village in the middle of the night. Okay, of course, completely against the Vinaya and so on. But that was the custom. And there was Upagupta's ceremonies always had something like that. They always had something a bit weird or a bit transgressive about them. So when Lumpur Panyanando was there, he said, "No, we can't do this against the Vinaya." And so they had, but the villagers are insisting, no, this is our custom, you have to do it. So these struggles you find all the time through the different traditions. And so this Mongkut was the one who introduced this mostly into the Thai tradition. Now he was followed by many others, but most significant was Ajahn Mun. He came, as you see, a number of years after Mongkut. And what Ajahn Mun essentially did was to take a similar approach, but to apply it to meditation, right? Mongkut was living mostly in a city study environment, so Ajahn Mun was in the forest and applied the same idea to the forest tradition. Now, previously, the Thai forest tradition was probably much more to do with black magic, curses, predicting the future, getting lottery numbers, all of that kind of fun stuff. And Adaman ruined it all. He came along and said, no, 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 we're not supposed to be telling next week's lottery number. We're supposed to be mindful of the present moment. Oh. And the Buddha didn't teach the Dhamma so that we could make curses on our enemies. He taught it so we could find freedom and liberation. Oh. So he looked back to what are the canonical meditations, the meditations that the Buddha himself taught, breath meditation, contemplation of the body, and so on and so forth. So in a similar way to Ledi Sayadaw, reforming the forms of meditation, if you look back at what went under the name of meditation before that in Theravadan countries, there's very little that you can actually find. But what you do find is much more in the lines of kind of visualizations, kind of mystic invocations of deities and these kinds of things, rather than the kinds of mindfulness meditations that we associate with the Theravada tradition today. And it was that generation, Ajahn Mun and Ledi Sayadaw, who introduced those ideas. Sri Lanka, again, reformed here. Here the greatest figure is probably Anagarika Dhammapala. Again, you look at his years from a similar period, and what a great face he has. Yeah, he's got this. He's like a lion. Yeah, he's just got this nobility to him. And Anagarika Dhammapala was not formally ordained, but he lived as an Anagarika. Possibly, I'm not sure whether he was the first, he actually invented the idea of the Anagarika, but anyway. His reform of Sinhalese Buddhism is often characterized as being Protestant. By Protestant, it means, well, it's a fairly vague word, but it means something like, well, looking at the authority of the scriptures rather than the authority of the church hierarchy. It possibly also means more of an emphasis on ethics and behavior rather than ritual. Yeah, these kinds of things. He, as well as having a huge influence on Sinhalese Buddhism, he also was responsible for reviving Buddhism in India. Up to that time, Buddhism had, apart from a few vestiges, had basically vanished from India. The English archaeologists had rediscovered many of the Buddhist holy sites, Bodh Gaya and Sarnath and so on. But there was no living Buddhist tradition in these places. They were just dead relics. And in fact, in some cases, particularly in Bodh Gaya, had been more or less appropriated by the Hindus in a fairly cynical way to keep Buddhists out and to be able to monopolize the tourist revenue. So Anagarika Dhammapala went to Bodh Gaya, tried to make it into a Buddhist place and a Buddhist place of pilgrimage. And those of you familiar with the politics of it would know that that is still not resolved today. Bodh Gaya is still actually officially run by a majority Hindu committee. And this is a completely outrageous situation that the most sacred site in Buddhism is actually controlled by Hindus. He was closely connected also with the Theosophical Society, on which I'll talk about more later, but the Theosophical Society was in many ways a sort of pioneer of what we could consider New Age religion, and the introduction of Buddhist or Asian spirituality in a sort of mystical introduction to the mystical Western tradition. So that this idea of early Buddhism wasn't just an intellectual tradition, right? So you've got people like Rhys Davids and so on who are doing the academic and scholarly work, but we also have it introduced into the astrology and kind of spiritualism, connecting with spirits of the dead and so on. And this was all linked up through the Theosophical Society. Anagarika Dhammapala was also one of the pioneers in the interfaith movement, which was getting started globally at the time. He participated in the first Parliament of World Religions, made quite an impact there, and was instrumental in putting Buddhism on the platform in its rightful place among world religions. The first Western Buddhist. most of you were not aware that one of the first Western Buddhas was in fact Gandalf. Yes, it's true. Actually, it's not Gandalf, but it might as well be Henry Steele Olcott and Madame Blavatsky. Don't you just wish that that was your name? It's like the best name ever. Hello, I'm Fred. Who are you? I am Madame Blavatsky. So, Madame Blavatsky, one of the foremost Western mystics of her time, founder of the Theosophical Society, a writer of vast treaties of esoteric doctrine, which she got from who knows where. She called herself a Buddhist with Henry, with Olcott. Olcott was seemed much more practical kind of person. He built schools in Sri Lanka, the Ananda College. Who went to the Ananda College in Sri Lanka? Anyone here went to? Yes, we have one over there. Anybody else? Okay. So, his school's still being used today. He formulated a Buddhist catechism. He helped to design the Buddhist flag, which you see there. I can't stand the Buddhist flag. I think it's awful, personally. But anyway, it's another kind of modern Buddhist thing. And both Madame Blavatsky and Olcott publicly converted to Buddhism on May the 19th, 1880 in Sri Lanka. And so they were the first kind of formal or well-known Western Buddhists in modern times. Okay, not the first Western Buddhists. The first Western Buddhist that we know of was Yonaka Dhammarakkhita in the time of King Ashoka, more than 2,000 years ago, the Greek Dhammarakkhita. Okay, he was a well-known teacher in the time of King Ashoka, and probably the founder of one of the early schools of Buddhism, the Dharmaguptaka schools. And so there must have been many Greeks. We don't know how Greek they actually were, from somewhere from the Greek cultural region anyway, born in Alexandria, at one of the Alexandrias. But in modern times, Madame Blavatsky and Olcott were the first, least well-known Buddhists. Shortly after they converted, it wasn't that long that we had the first Buddhist monks. I think Nyanatiloka was, what year was Nyanatiloka ordained? Would have been not long after that. 1902, okay. So 1902, so that's only 20 years later. And there are rumours of some Westerners who ordained before that, but not huge amounts of information. Olcott described his own religion as being pure primitive Buddhism. Okay, not necessarily sure exactly how accurate he was, but what's more important than the details of that is the idea that that's what he thought he was practicing, that's what he wanted to be practicing, that's what he believed was important to be practicing, pure, original, primitive Buddhism. There are some interesting connections here with Australia. Olcott actually visited Australia and visited Sydney. The Theosophical Society was very prominent in Sydney around that time. And a little historical detail that most Australian Buddhists don't know, that on Balmoral Beach in Sydney was built for a period of 30 years the Star Amphitheatre. And there's a picture you can see there. It was built for the lectures of Krishnamurti, who was supposed to have been the world teacher of the Theosophical Society, and according to rumour and legend, was meant to be the place that the saviour was going to appear, either Maitreya Buddha or Jesus returning or whoever. Theosophists didn't tend to be too specific when it comes to details like that, right? And so, you know, you can see what a magnificent place that is. Unfortunately, was demolished, and there's a really ugly block of flats there now. But if you do ever visit Sydney, it's really worth going. If you go down to Balmoral Beach, you turn left, you go along to the left part of the beach, you'll see this ugly block of flats from the 1950s, obviously, after this was demolished. And on the front, there's a plaque, and you can see where this was. In the background, you can see Sydney Heads. And if you stand there and you think to yourself, when I stood there, I thought to myself, well, look, if I was Maitreya, I wouldn't mind appearing here. I think this would be terrific. Yeah. So I think that's quite a lovely piece of Buddhist history in Australia. So it's interesting. I find these things fascinating because we often think that this is something new that we're doing as we're introducing Buddhism in the West and so on, right? But here we have an example of something which is not only introduced; it's already dead and gone. It's been forgotten for more than half a century. It's already ancient history, and this is that legacy has been going on for so long. Okay. Not only do we have the Western Buddhists and scholars and so on, but the first Western awesome yogi. And why she has been forgotten so much, I do not know. Alexandra David Neal. There she is, looking magnificent, looking awesome, right? I mean, the very definition of awesome. And here's her CV, right? Imagine putting this on your CV. She's a Belgian-French explorer, spiritualist, opera singer, Freemason, Buddhist, anarchist, and writer. Yeah? That's pretty good, isn't it? Yeah? She had one of these incredible lives. I don't think you can do that these days. Everywhere is too explored and too safe and so on. But she travelled all over. She's travelled to India and Japan and all of these places. She studied Buddhism very deeply. She wrote over 30 books on Buddhism. And she had a very good knowledge of Buddhism, which, again, she learnt, again, the same era we're talking about. And she learnt from Thomas Rhys Davids and these translations and the bringing of the Buddhist culture into a Western idiom for the first time, but also by going to the Buddhist countries and studying with the people there. In 1912, she met the 13th Dalai Lama. Right? Imagine what that would be like, 1912, to travel to Tibet and meet the 13th Dalai Lama. In 1914 to 1916, she lived in a cave in Sikkim. Right? There's this French woman living in a cave in Sikkim. And while she was there, she popped over the border illegally into Tibet. And so it was 1916, 1924 and 1937 she visited Tibet and some of her accounts of her, because of course this was like the old days in Tibet, right? This is before they had, they had virtually no contact with the West. And one of her, probably her best known book is I think called Magic and Mysteries of Tibet, something like that. And absolutely fantastic read, yeah, all of these totally outrageous stories that she's got in there. And after, I'm not sure exactly how long she was in Tibet in that last time, but in 1946 she returned to France and basically lived till virtually 100 as a recluse in France. Now, I'm not sure whether she was, you can see she's wearing some kind of robes there. I don't know whether she was formally ordained as a nun or more living as a kind of the Tibetan Lama, lay Lama kind of thing. Yeah, but with her, I think the young man with her, I think, is a Nepalese monk who she adopted as her son and travelled with her a lot, especially in the later part of her life. So again, this is another aspect of that idea of search for early Buddhism is the search for an experience, right? Not just the search for an idea, which is what Rhys Davids and others, they wanted to find out what is the philosophy of Buddhism, right? They wanted a set of ideas and so on, which might have an ethical implication or something, but they didn't really know anything about meditation, right? Nothing. The idea of meditation was completely foreign to them. Whereas with Alexandra David Neal, we see for the first time sort of a search for that experience and that contemplative practice. The idea of early Buddhism is not just something which has energized most of these. I've talked about Theravada. Of course, Alexandra David Neal had experience with both Theravada and the Tibetan traditions. I won't talk too much about the Mahayana tradition, but just to note that similar tendencies are found within the modern Mahayana traditions as well. And here's just a couple of examples of that. In the 1920s, the Taisho Tripitaka was published, And this was the first real kind of modern text-critical edition of the Chinese canon. The Chinese Tripitaka, Chinese canon, is extremely large. It's much bigger than the Pali canon. And it contains, it's not really a Tripitaka in the same sense. It's not sort of neatly divided into, you know, suttas, vinaya and abhidhamma, but it's more just a massive compendium of all the writings on Buddhism over the millennia. When this modern edition was done by the Taisho University in Japan, it was actually students of the German scholar Max Müller. They traveled to Germany. They learnt the modern Western techniques of text critical studies using footnotes, giving variant readings, all of these kinds of things. They came back to Japan and they did what is an astonishing work of modern scholarship and created the Taisho Tripitaka, which is still used today. When they published that, and this is something that's actually very interesting, if you look in the contents of the Taisho Tripitaka, you can see that the first set of books there is called the Dirgha Agama, which is equivalent to the Pali Digha Nikaya. The second set is the Madhyama Agama, which is equivalent to the Pali Majjhima Nikaya. Third is Sanyukta Agama, and the fourth is the Ekottara Agama, equivalent to the Anguttara Nikaya. It's the same books that begin the Taisho canon that are also found in the Pali scriptures, and they're in the same order. Yeah? That's not a coincidence. They reorganized the Chinese Tripitaka in order to fit the same pattern as found with the Pali canon. Okay, so this is how you see that these traditions are actually mutually influencing each other, right down to the present day. And even the very form of the canonical texts is still being mutually shaped. One of the great researchers and teachers of this area in modern East Asian Buddhism was Master Yinshun. And Master Yinshun is probably the most famous monk in modern Taiwanese Buddhism. He just passed away a few years ago. Was an astonishing scholar. And he, one of the ideas which he developed or helped to lay the groundwork for was the idea of engaged Buddhism, which is again a very popular idea today. For example, Thich Nhat Hanh in his early years travelled to Taiwan, and this is where he picked up these ideas of engaged Buddhism. Also, Anagarika Dhammapala also introduced similar ideas in the Sri Lankan context. So this is the idea of Buddhism as being a relevant and practical, getting socially engaged, helping people, poor people, helping feed and educate and so on, rather than just being a kind of remote philosophy that's practiced in the universities or practiced in the monasteries. So, but Master Yinshun, as his life went on, returned more and more to the early Buddhist scriptures, to the what we call the Agamas. And we're going to look more at the content of these and how they relate, the Pali and the Chinese texts relate. Yinshun himself didn't read Pali, but he read the Pali texts in a Japanese translation. And as his life went on, he more and more emphasized that these were, in fact, the core teachings of early Buddhism, and these are the teachings which can be traced to the historical Buddha. This is, of course, very radical for somebody within the Mahayana context to say these things, right? And only somebody with Yinshun's authority and gravitas could actually get away with it without everybody just either condemning him or ridiculing him or ignoring him. And so he's really put this idea of early Buddhism on the map, especially in Taiwan and to a lesser extent in the other East Asian Buddhist countries. So it's now very common that the monks and nuns from Taiwanese Buddhism will travel to Sri Lanka or to Burma or to other places to learn about Pali Buddhism and so on. And it's now quite acceptable to do that. Yinshun argued that when he talked about the relationship between early Buddhism and Mahayana, he said that the ideas of early Mahayana, especially early Mahayana, were largely similar to those of the early Buddhist texts, but were reformulated in a way to emphasize the teachings in a way that was relevant for a different time and place. So he admitted that the texts were written later, but he argued that they had the same doctrine reformulated in a different way. So this is how he harmonized those things. Yes, I am. Early Mahayana, we date from around 500 years after the Buddha. Yeah, maybe a little bit earlier than that, maybe starting 400 years, but roughly about 500 years after the Buddha. Yeah. We know the dates of the early Mahayana scriptures because the translation dates are recorded in the Chinese translations. So the translations start from around that time, around 100, 200, 300 AD, and so we assume that they existed in India sometime before that. Yeah. And what's that? Okay. So the question is, are we going to touch on Mahayana and Hinayana? Not if I can help it. So this is a discussion mostly on early Buddhism, and that's more of a discussion on Buddhist history and Buddhist sects. Another very worthwhile topic, but it just might get a little bit from our main thread. Just to briefly say that for the first... The period of early... We haven't really talked about a timeline yet. Ajahn Brahmali will look more at the dates of the Buddha and so on. But when we're talking about early Buddhism, essentially, from my point of view, it means the Buddhism that the Buddha taught, the Buddhism as understood in the community in the time of the Buddha, and for a few generations afterwards. Okay, and that's when I believe we can meaningfully talk about early Buddhism. From that period on, so let's say from about 100 years after the Buddha, we start to see the gradual emergence of the different sects of Buddhism. Okay, so the first sect's probably maybe 200 years something after Buddhism, and so that's what we call the 18 schools of early Buddhism. We'll talk a little bit about that later. And then about 500 years after the Buddha, we see the emergence of the Mahayana. Yeah. And then another 500 years after that, the emergence of the Vajrayana or Tantrayana, which is the kind of Buddhism that's dominant in Tibet. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, so we should stop for another meditation. And now moving to the look in a bit more detail at the timeline. So, okay, so here we have some dates for you, because I know how much everybody loves dates. Life of the Buddha, roughly 480 to 400 BC. Now, the dates of the life of the Buddha are controversial, and it's not really settled amongst scholars. The history of the dating is quite a complex history in itself. But the general tendency among the contemporary Indologists is to look to a date of the Buddha's parinibbana. Usually the main date that we try to fix in Buddha studies is the date the Buddha passed away. And the usual date we center around these days is around 400 BCE. Most sources that you'll see will quote a date closer to 480 BCE for the Buddha's parinibbana, and that was the date that was accepted for most of the 20th century. But these days, most scholars look to around 400 BCE for the Buddha's passing away. And we know the Buddha lived for 80 years, so 480 to 400 BCE. That's quite the significance of that is that it allows us to place the life of the Buddha in a meaningful historical context. We can compare what it says in the Buddhist scriptures with what we find from archaeological excavations, with what is found in other historical sources, for example, the Hindu histories or the Greek and other Western histories, and we can compare them and to see how reliable the Buddhist traditions are. Perhaps the most well-fixed and well-understood date in the whole period are the dates of King Ashoka. And so we put here the dates 268 to 234 for King Ashoka's reign. That's his years of reigning, isn't it? Yeah, it's his years of reigning. So you can see from that he came to the throne, 130 years or so after the Buddha. Yeah. So not all that long after the time of the Buddha, right? There are legends in some traditions that that there were one or two people alive in the time of Ashoka who still remembered the Buddha. Whether that's true or not, but it does indicate that according to the traditions, there wasn't that long in between the Buddha and Ashoka. The reason, of course, we know about Ashoka very well is because we have many edicts of Ashoka, many inscriptions. He's the first Indian king, the first, in fact, Indian historical figure at all who we have lengthy inscriptions for. There's almost no Indian writing that predates Ashoka, maybe a few bits and pieces here and there. There's the Indus Valley, which is much older, hasn't been deciphered, but King Ashoka's writings are the oldest historical and substantive writings of any form in India that we have. Ashoka was, of course, a Buddhist, and as a Buddhist, he promoted the Dharma. He didn't promote Buddhism. So he promoted Dharma, meaning he promoted ethical conduct, he promoted good principles, he promoted kindness, he promoted being nice to animals. He set up veterinary services and medicines for humans and animals all throughout his realm. I feel like it's just amazing. You know, you read all of these ancient kings, right, and all these edicts, it's all kind of smiting and I am the greatest and I'm going to kill all you and I've smitten all my... And King Ashoka's like, ah, I did this had this war and I killed all these people and I'm really sorry. Can you forgive me? And I'm really going to try my best to make up for it, you know, and let's be nice to each other and let's stop killing animals and stuff. He's absolutely amazing. And so it's from the time of King Ashoka, which we can firmly date, right, that we trace the advent of Buddhism as the major religious trend in India. Okay, now there's this kind of myth in Western culture, I think in world culture, which is a myth promulgated primarily by the Hindu pundits from their own historic legends, and brought into the Western consciousness by people like Madame Blavatsky and the Theosophical Society, is this idea that India is this timeless Hindu nation, that India has always been Hindu and this has never changed and so on and so forth. It's rubbish. India is just a place like any other. It's got its history. It changed over time. And it seems that for maybe 1,000 years or so, from the time of Ashoka, for about 1,000 years, certainly in terms of the archaeological evidence, Buddhist evidence is dominant over that entire period. Okay, after about 500 AD, the Buddhist influence slowly started to decline for reasons that are not entirely obvious. But it was still present up till about 1200 AD. So for much of Indian history, Buddhism was a dominant, if not the dominant, religion over much of the area, remembering, of course, that India was a very diverse place with different kingdoms and different religions and stuff happening everywhere. So the Buddha taught from 480 to 400 BCE. When he passed away, he had established a strong following. There was a monastic order, bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. There was the lay community, upasakas and upasikas. He was just one of many religious teachers at that time. Ultimately, of course, the most successful and the most famous. But in those days, we shouldn't think of Buddhism as being, you know, the powerful world religion that it is today. It was a relatively small affair. Most of the monks and nuns and so on would have known each other. You know, there would have probably been, I guess, maybe a few thousand monastics or something like that. Who knows? A larger circle of lay followers. But there was a lot of fear. You can see from the text at the time when the Buddha passed away, what's going to happen now? Yeah, this Dhamma that we've got is so precious, it's so wonderful, it's so amazing. Is that just going to disappear? I mean, we know what happens to most religions, right? There's plenty of cults and religious teachers and so on everywhere, right? And almost every case, they teach, they gather some followers, and then after they die, or usually after they have some kind of scandal or something like that, but if they make it to their death without any scandals, then after a little while, everything kind of gradually dissipates and falls apart, right? So this is only reasonable to expect that the same thing would happen to Buddhism. And it seems that all the indications are that the early generations of Buddhists didn't really expect Buddhism to be around for more than probably a few hundred years at best. Right? I certainly don't think that they ever anticipated this, right? They never thought that we'd be talking in Australia about early Buddhism, projecting stuff with laptops and slide projectors and stuff like that, right? This wasn't in their consciousness. So after the Buddha died, there's a lot of fear and a tremendous effort to preserve his words. An astonishing, unrepeated, unprecedented effort. There's nothing like the Buddhist literature anywhere in the world. If we compare what we have from what the Buddha taught with anybody from that same period, it's a radically different kind of thing. Confucius, we have like a few writings and so on, but Confucius actually wrote. It wasn't an oral tradition. You have various inscriptions and so on in Mesopotamia, Egypt, places like this, but they're fairly small texts, relatively speaking. You have some Greek philosophers from that period, but even the Greek philosophers from the time of the Buddha, most of them are lost. And only a few we have fragments which are written down by their students, and a relatively small number, Socrates being the first one we have substantial amounts for, roughly contemporary with the Buddha. In India, there's various Hindu scriptures and so on, but these are like collections of different sages. What we have from each sage is relatively small, just a few passages, a few dialogues from this sage or from that sage. There's nothing like this idea where you have thousands of discourses from one teacher preserved in one whole system, right? So you imagine the effort and the work it takes. You think, oh, it's too much effort to pick the things up and read them, right? And you're making excuses, but they had to memorize them all, okay? And the amount of work that it took to put all these things together, to even conceive of a literature on this scale in a purely oral tradition, to organize the teams of people, monks and nuns and lay people, to recite these things, to memorize them, the whole system of ensuring that the memorization happened correctly and that they would come together to check each other's pronunciation and recitation and all of those things. It's a phenomenal effort. And behind that phenomenal effort, there must be something. And this is something which is, you know, there are people who will question, well, did the Buddha exist, or did the Buddha's texts, do they even come from the Buddha, were they invented later, and so on. But none of these inquiries explain, where did this energy come from? Why did this happen? Surely the most rational and sensible explanation for why all of this effort was made was the most obvious one, was that because there really was a Buddha who taught this teaching, which really was amazing and did influence so many people so profoundly. And it's because of that, and that almost that revolution in consciousness that happened in India at the time, that impelled so many people to put so much effort for such a long time to memorizing and passing down these teachings. Never assume. Yeah, go on. That's right, yeah. There actually, some can, and even today there are a few monks who can memorize the entire canon. But for the most part, yes, this is one of the things that they did, was they separated out the scriptures. So you see, Ajahn Brahmali will talk more about this later on, but we have the different, what we call Nikayas, the Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, and so on. And it seems like most reciters would specialize in one or other of those Nikayas, and that they would also sub-specialize within that. So they would learn like a core curriculum, and then it would be coordinated so that different monks would learn different parts of it. And then, of course, ones who had very good memories could then learn bigger sections, and a few might know the whole thing. But yes, and this, you know, again, just to think how systematic that is to actually work and organize that, right? You can't coordinate it on Facebook, yeah? You have to actually walk from one monastery to another monastery and organize it. It's a phenomenal thing to do. Okay, yeah. Right. Mm. Oh, yeah, still reciting. Yeah, the oral tradition is still very much alive. Yeah. Even, for example, the Buddhist text. I'm involved in a project for putting the Buddhist text online, and the text that we're using was edited by a Thai group. And when they did the proofreading for their edition, they had it thoroughly proofread three times and also recited three times. Okay, so to check for mistakes. And this is one of the best ways to check for mistakes. You actually sit there with two or three people reciting it, and it's very obvious when they recite different things. Yeah, you can hear it very clearly. So this is still used today for ensuring the accuracy of the text. Eddie, yeah. Much later, another 1,000 years later, late Buddhism. Yes, 1,000 years later. No. 1,000 years later. 1,000 years later. Maybe had earlier roots, but from what we can see, yeah, probably about 1,000 years later. Yeah. I mean, there was probably colleges and tradition there earlier, but yeah. So, just briefly over the list here, the Buddha died about 400 BCE. Only about 80 years later, we had the appearance of Chandragupta. In 322 BCE, Chandragupta was preceded briefly by Alexander. He invaded India shortly before that and was repelled by the reign. The kings at the time were the Nanda dynasty. And the Nandas had already established a realm over much of northern India. Chandragupta extended that to include basically all of northern India except for one region called Kalinga and much of what would be currently Pakistan and Bangladesh and far to the south as well, though not everywhere in the south. So around the same time as Chandragupta is held the Second Council. Second Council is very important, mainly because it gives us like a final date for the events depicted in the early Buddhist texts. So that's about 100 years after the Buddha passed away. There was a dispute among the Sangha about the interpretation of some Vinaya rules. There was a great gathering of the Sangha from everywhere around India, and they discussed and resolved that dispute. And that happened about 100 years after the Buddha. And the account of that is found within the Buddhist scriptures themselves. Okay, so this is why when we're talking about the early Buddhist scriptures, it doesn't just mean things that were spoken by the Buddha or in the lifetime of the Buddha. Other things were added to it. And in the early canonical collection, this is about the final date, roughly, that things were added to it. And we find a few other suttas and things that were added up to about that period. But it seems like there was little or nothing added after that period. Maybe one or two bits and pieces, but not very much substantially added after that period. So the time of Chandragupta and Ashoka is significant because they give us a concrete historical dates from which we can infer the presence of Buddhism in India. Ashoka, in his edicts, is constantly referring to Buddhist ideas, terms like bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, and the names of Buddhist scriptures that he lists, ideas like dana, and some quite radical concepts. For example, in several of his edicts, he says he doesn't give much weight to rituals and mangalas, to auspicious signs, Of course, and instead he thinks the real mangala, the real auspicious, is doing good, being generous, caring for your parents, and so on and so forth. It's exactly the same teaching as we find in the Pali Canon in the Mangala Sutta, And this is exactly the same as found in the Ashokan edicts. It's a very radical teaching for a culture which has been imbued for centuries with the Vedic culture, with practicing of rituals and rites and the idea of how important and central these things are. And so for the king, the first emperor of India, to say, not really, this stuff's a bit of a waste of time, bathing in the Ganges and all of these kinds of things, I really wouldn't bother about it too much. But, kindness is really important, Truthfulness is really important. And so this is where these Buddhist ethical teachings are really being put first and foremost in the cultural sphere in India. I've said there the Mahasanghika schism around 150 BCE. This marks the time where there was first schism between the early schools of Buddhism and between what's called Mahasanghika and the Thera, Stavira, or the Theravada school. Most histories that you will read of early Buddhism will tell you that that schism happened much earlier. They will often say that that first schism happened after the Second Council. They are wrong. I know, because I wrote the book. So if you want to read more about that, you can read my scintillating historical account called Sects and Sectarianism. That is not Sects and Secretaries, which is actually how it got introduced when I was doing a talk once. They said, this is Bhante Sujato, the author of Sects and Secretaries. And I'm like, Okay, admittedly, it'd probably be more interesting, but sects and sectarianism is a complicated historical argument I don't need to get into here, but basically what we can see over this period from the time of the death of the Buddha through Ashoka, we can see the emergence of the tendencies which resulted in the Buddhist schools, okay? The specialization in terms of different philosophies, discussion of interpretations of ideas and so on and so forth. But we don't see the actual emergence of fully fledged schools, that these communities who saw themselves as distinct and other and separate from other Buddhist communities. It was just the Buddhist communities and some people in there might have some different ideas. So around 150 AD, sorry, BCE, we see that emergence. The time of King Ashoka is also very important because at the time, that time, missionaries were sent all over India. And the most famous one, of course, Mahinda was sent to Sri Lanka, and other missionaries were sent to Kashmir, Gandhara in modern-day Afghanistan and Pakistan, to Aparantika in the west. Yonika Dhammarakita went to Alasanda, to the Greek communities, and other places all around India to establish Buddhist communities in those places. And it's from there that we see, I think, the main growth of the different sects and schools of Buddhism as the local regions tended to develop their own particular teachings, philosophies, interpretations and practices. And I think that's the main reason for the emergence of the different schools. It's not that the schools separated first and then went to the different places. They went to the different places and gradually evolved in their different interpretations from there. For the most part, it's a complicated situation, but I think that's the main tendency. Yes, briefly. Second Council was in Vaisali. Yeah, so that's still in the old area of Buddhism. Yeah. Okay, so it's now 10:30, so we'll have to break now. So we'll go over and have the Dana. Ajahn Brahmali will continue with the presentation at after Dana at 12:30. So we look forward to seeing you all then.